From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The advent of the internet came with visions of a democratic future, where things like free speech and equality and prosperity would be unleashed from the forces that held them back. But today's economy, increasingly dominated by digital technology, has given rise to the so-called gig economy of poorly paid and insecure jobs. Disinformation and fake news are distorting our elections, and racism and hate is spreading. Writing in a new book about how we can indeed take back the internet and steer it to live up to its proclaimed ideals is Ramesh Srinivasan. He's a professor of information studies and design media arts at UCLA. His earlier books include Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World, and After the Internet. He now joins me to discuss his new book, Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
Hi, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm very happy to share this new book, Beyond the Valley, with you.
And I imagine that by using the word innovators, you're not talking about the founders of Uber and Facebook. You're talking about people who are trying to combat what Uber and Facebook have done. So let's talk about how the internet, far from actually delivering on a promise of greater democracy, seems to have done, in some respects, the opposite. Here in the US itself, I mentioned there's the issue of the gig economy, elections being undermined. Has the internet failed to live up to its original sort of promise?
Yeah, absolutely, Sonali. So I did use the word innovators in the title of Beyond the Valley because I'm trying to take that term back. There's a lot of terms that have been hijacked discursively by big tech companies. Innovation is one of them. Another one is disruption. Our future has really been hijacked by these tech companies. Absolutely. What occurred with the internet, which was publicly funded by taxpayer money, which just turned 50 years old. The web was also a nonprofit, a nonprofit initiative as well, is it has been privatized. It has been centralized by corporate power that basically determines how we communicate with one another, how we find information, how information finds us. But actually, far more expansively than that, these corporate technological forces aren't just about Facebook. They're not even just about Amazon. They're about determining the language and experiences by which all of us increasingly will live. As an example, a company like Uber claims to be a technology company, but it's actually the biggest taxi company in the history of the world. Or consider Facebook, which claims to be a technology company, but is actually the biggest media company in the history of the world. So you can basically see technologization in the image of private corporate one percenter interests only interested in expanding their own valuation and maximizing their profits have taken over the so-called open internet as we know it. And part of that is actually not surprising, because as the amount of information on the internet exponentialized because of what you post, Sonali, what I post, etc., we actually had to turn to technologies to make sense of the noise, right? To kind of help direct us. And they deserve, the companies that created these technologies deserve some compensation for creating great technologies that allowed for efficiency. But it shouldn't have been hijacked at the costs of everything else. And that is the issue. We're seeing private, corporate-driven technologization of our world harming workers, harming indigenous peoples, harming women, harming people of color and minorities, harming activists, harming communities across the global South that I know you and I both care deeply about, coming from, you know, South Asia ourselves, harming democracy, even in our country. So in a sense, it's very unfortunate for the world, but because I've been writing about these issues for almost 20 years and always been interested in how people can take power over technology as a contrast to this corporatization, it's now time for a lot of my work to become very mainstream. And that's why I'm very excited that this book, Beyond the Valley, is out, because I'm able to take this message to so many mainstream and progressive media networks.
I want to focus on some of the ways in which we ourselves as users of the internet, have become the product. And in a way, that's what you cover in the first part of your book. Our every motions are tracked, our faces are, you know, churned through facial recognition technologies. Every piece of data, every click that engage in on the internet is tracked and monetized, and we, rather than using the internet, are being used by the internet.
Excellent point. Are we Googling or are we being Googled? Are we socializing on Facebook or are we being socialized by Facebook? Mm. Just look, again, the language is really important here. That's why I use the term innovator in the title. The language actually hijacks the criticality that we need to fight back and push back. Absolutely, you're absolutely spot on with that analysis, Sonali.
So the issue of our democracy being undermined is also a critical part of this. And of course, we should acknowledge that people have used the internet for greater democratization, not because of Facebook, but maybe in spite of what Facebook has done. You know, we've seen the Arab Spring revolts right now, for example, in Iran, as you and I are talking, there are mass protests. And one of the things that the government did was to shut down the internet because they see that as being this tool by which people are communicating with one another directly, a similar situation in Hong Kong. So people have certainly been able to use the internet to further their democratic rights, but democracy has also greatly eroded because of the internet, right?
That's such it's an excellent set of examples. Well, when people take power over technologies, especially technologies that are internet or network-based, and it doesn't even have to be the internet per se, for example, in Hong Kong, there was a lot of use of Bluetooth technology, just kind of local networks in ways. When people take power over the ability of technology to build connections between otherwise disaggregated, decentralized peers, bringing people together, bringing the crowd together through a peer-to-peer, each of us have our own voice, each of us can create our own networks. That's what's so powerful about the internet. And we've seen examples like that throughout history. In the Arab world, very few people. I was in Egypt for off and on for 3 years writing about technology and Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring. And it wasn't so much how many people were using the internet, it's the fact that these activists were using the internet to manipulate and shape and impact journalistic coverage of what they were doing. You see, it's all about the idea of taking these technologies as tools to take power over in the image of who you are, where you are, and the environment within which you're situated. So it's not about the naive use of the internet that can create a democratic change. It's the ability to use these specific tools in ways that you have power over. And that is an example we have seen throughout history. Occupy, a lot of internet technologies were used during Occupy. You know, back in the day, and you know, in the 90s, the Zapatistas were able to globalize their struggle using Usenet forums and news groups. And so all of these are capacities that are latent and that can be activated through the use of the internet. But what we also see occurring is every form of exchange, especially today, you know, like say you and I send one another an email, Sonali, someone is sitting in the middle. It's not even a person, it's a computational system that is optimized to extract what we are sending to one another for data ownership, for data manipulation, and for corporate profit in ways that we have very little understanding around as users, and even I as a scholar of these themes. It's the third party that is manipulating and monetizing for private rather than public value and benefit. That's that third party that at scale is able to erode democracies.
And they use these algorithms that then take a life of their own. We've covered this with other books. People have written whole books about algorithms and how they tend to skew toward, eventually far-right ideologies and approaches. And you point out in your book as well how sort of algorithms that use facial recognition technology amplify the biases of the creators, where you have the sort of racial injustice perpetrated through algorithmic means, all again undermining this great promise that the internet was supposed to bring to our societies, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so an algorithm is a set of instructions that you feed to a computer to process some body of data. But if those instructions are fed by dominantly, obviously, private, you know, corporate actors who tend to be racially and demographically westernized, white, sometimes Asian, and dominantly male, and they export those algorithms upon the world to monetize, mine, extract, and create, you know, information and content that can then be fed into behaviorally shaping and impacting people, then what you start seeing are these massive disconnections, because we always build algorithms, just like I wrote this book, based on who I am, right? So those biases that I have just as a person, let alone as a potential algorithm developer for Google, are going to infiltrate the way I build that learning technology. So that's part one. Part two is, if you feed these algorithms data sets based on the world as it is, those algorithms are going to reinforce, normalize, and actually amplify the harm and violence that is that vulnerable people of color, women, working poor people face. So that's why the algorithms actually reinforce and amplify various forms of injustice and inequality, more or less as it stands. Just as some examples that I give in Beyond the Valley, in the new book, facial recognition systems across the board misidentify prominent folks like Oprah, Serena Williams, Michelle Obama. They all think that these are men, right? Incredible, right? This includes Chinese facial recognition technologies, because Chinese technologies are also dominant on a global scale. Another example, if you searched for gorillas on Google in the image recognition system, it would retrieve images of black people. So how did Google deal with that? It temporarily, at least temporarily, disabled gorillas from its image search, right? So the underlying architecture of racism, colonialism, Western capital dominance and power, and Chinese capital dominance and power, which is a type of surveillance authoritarian capitalism, those are the ideologies that imprint themselves onto the technologies that come to our fingertips. And we don't just provide data, Sonali, when we are Facebooking or tweeting or commenting or liking. We are feeding these systems data 24/7, 365, because our geolocatable data is provided. In fact, there's some evidence that shows that a company like Facebook, which shouldn't be understood as just Facebook, the technology, but the company that owns WhatsApp, that owns facial recognition technologies, that owns Instagram, there's some evidence that Facebook gathers data on people who have never in their lives even created a Facebook account. So this is about a completely asymmetric blind tunnel. We're blindly being led into a tunnel that is extracting, manipulating, and disenfranchising us.
And of course, you brought up how the a company like Uber, rather than being a technology company, is really a glorified taxi company with a cool app. And the gig economization of the economy is another section in your book, and another way in which the internet just hasn't lived up to its ideal. So I want to spend a lot of time on how one can actually take the internet back. And you point out a really interesting example in your book of the way in which people with fewer resources can cleverly harness the technology of the internet for greater justice, for greater democracy. And you use the example of Bernie Sanders, or maybe I should say Bertie Sanders, that viral moment in the 2016 election campaign of Bernie Sanders that helped catapult him inadvertently onto the national and really international scene. Tell us what happened there and how it's an example of people being able to take the internet back.
Yeah, it's a great point. And actually, I argue in the book that the real innovators of technology are the ones who do less, do more with less. You know? And are actually, that in that sense, the term innovation is actually about being resourceful. It's about hustling. It's about making means, making ends meet with whatever you have around you. And that can mean a lot of different things.
My producer and I on this program know exactly what you're talking about. Two people being able to produce a daily 5 hours a week program because of digital technology.
Yep, exactly. And to hustling. Some you know, the Young Turks, who I guest host for here in Los Angeles, are also an upstart example of that, that managed to blow up to the extent they did. And it's really independent, independent media, journalists with integrity like yourself and them, who are really it's voices like that that have the potential to be activated by the internet. So to your question about Senator Sanders, and full disclosure, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Sonali, I'm actually a national surrogate for Senator Sanders. So I should say that up front. So I'm a major supporter of his campaign and actually part of the campaign. What Senator Sanders believes in, and what I describe in Beyond the Valley, and by the way, my joining the campaign only happened after I published this book, but really, it's another model of the internet. It's one that we remember, and we see some examples of now, and we even see it right now in relation to Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. Use the internet as a catalyst to bring working middle class 99% together. In very simple ways, you know, pass on this petition. That's, you know, Sanders doesn't do that as much, but that was a classic model. $19, $27, that's what it was last time, $27. Just give what you can. And together, because there's so many more people in this country who are working in middle class, I mean, dominantly, right? In a country with three people having equivalent wealth to almost 195 million people. Can you believe we live in this time period, Sonali? What is the way to overcome that entrenched power? The only way is to bring the masses together. And the internet does have that capacity of taking small-scale events and making them huge, right? The virality is possible. But also, in this case, it's a lot like a word we used to use when we described the internet about a decade ago, crowdsourcing. Bring the crowd together. And that's exactly what Bernie Sanders does. Volunteers are enlisted. People are able to associate it with other Sanders supporters in their own communities. People can give just $3, $7, whatever. If you look at Bernie Sanders' campaign right now, it's dominantly working class donors. The largest donor group overall are Walmart employees and overall are teachers.
Wow.
These are the most well-paid people in our society. In fact, Bernie Sanders led a strike at Walmart to try to fight for a living wage and benefits and stuff for Walmart employees, as he's done with at Disney, Amazon, trying to do at McDonald's. He just does it across the board. So this is kind of what is powerful at this moment. A lot of us, this is kind of incredible. You know, even Republicans across this country, actually in many parts of the world, there is bipartisan cross-demographic agreement that this tech stuff has become too imbalanced. Everyone has their own reasons for it. 48 attorney generals are investigating doing a lawsuit of Facebook. It's pretty incredible that this is happening. So in response to this populism that feels like entrenched power has gone too far, at least in tech, we see counter movements that are now nationally powerful. And I know you met Senator Sanders briefly. I remember you tweeting about that or showing that to me or something like that. This is why his time has come, because it represents a whole other model of bringing the people together. And actually, it is a very powerful and promising example of what the internet might mean moving into 2020.
So beyond being able to harness those parts of the digital technology that are still available to us, how can we go on the offensive? How can people who are interested in seeing the internet be an equalizing force, wrested out of the greedy, profit-hungry hands of the likes of Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and, you know, the founders of Uber and all of these other companies that are seeking to essentially make it a profit-driven model at the expense of our rights? How do we wrest it back?
Exactly, because what we have right now is a zero-sum ideology that's infecting our entire country, shaking democracies and disenfranchising people of color and working class people and women in certain cases as well. Yes, there's a lot we can do. So often as individual users, we feel helpless. We feel overwhelmed, partly because we have no idea what's going on. We don't know what's known about us. We don't know how that data could be used. We don't know. Very few of us know that our credit card records can be bought and sold. It feels like we are just being toyed with by forces far removed from our control that we'll have no visibility around. So I get that sentiment, but there is a lot we can do. In Beyond the Valley, in the new book, I argue for what I call a digital bill of rights, and that is really important. And in that bill of rights, what I argue for is a total disclosure that every single person who has data collected about them needs to know what's being collected about them, by whom, for what purposes. That's part one. Part two is we need to own our personal data. Once we know who has what on us, we need to be able to let people know, hey, fine, we don't maybe want your services, or we want your services to this degree only, but this is all you can know about us. This is all you can have about us. That's a second part of it. So these are forms of like legislation, but also journalists like yourself helping publicize this and build a movement around this is a lot what we can do. A third major issue is we need to look at the regulatory aspects of this antitrust legislation and see if it is viable and if these indeed are monopolies or not. For me, it's less about just resting on that, but more about analyzing and scrutinizing what happens when outsized power infects our lives in all these ways. But also very, very importantly, I'll just mention two other points. Every single person whose life, their livelihood, whether it's their democratic livelihood as voters or whether they're working people economically are at risk, every one of those people needs to be offered with alternatives and transitions so that they can be assured that they are living within a democratic society and that they are, if they are being affected by a gig economy that disenfranchises them, and every study shows this, $4 to $5 an hour Uber drivers make on average, without benefits, without pensions, without a living wage, obviously, without unionization, though we're trying to change that here in California. So we need solutions to those macroeconomic issues that end up harming working people as well. And then the last point I want to make is we need disclosure every time we interact with an AI system, an artificial intelligence system, because we're interacting with these so-called intelligence systems when we don't even know it, right? When we walk around in a city and it's a so-called smart city that's monitoring our behavior, we're interacting with AI. So we need to know when, we need public disclosure every single time we interact with an AI system. And more importantly, we need to understand how those AI systems are being built. So for example, a predictive policing system that tends to disproportionately identify Latinx and obviously Black and Brown communities of all forms as at risk or criminalizing them, that system, instead of just having these disastrous effects on these people, needs to be designed, if it even exists at all, by those communities. Imagine if LAPD or a private tech contractor didn't have power over predictive policing, but Black Lives Matter did, right? That's kind of the way we need to invert who has power over the design and development of these systems, and we have to audit to those systems. Meaning, these, you know, Facebook used to, in kind of a glib way, brag about the whole, you know, move fast and break things. That used to be their sort of motto, if you will. Well, they've done a great job breaking stuff. They're responsible for violence and death all over the world in places like Myanmar, in Sri Lanka, with Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, and so on. So no more of that. Now, anytime a Facebook or other global or other powerful technology impacts a group of people, it has to be audited by those people, by those user communities. So these are just a set of very specific steps that we can take. And you know, if we notice, for example, in the 2020 campaign, very few candidates are really addressing the systemic risks of this in a head-on way. The reason I joined Senator Sanders' campaign is he's not interested in tech in and of itself. He's interested in worker and people's power. And so I'm, you know, attempting to assist them with the tech side of things as well.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Ramesh, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Everyone check out Beyond the Valley. And, you know, we'll be actually doing an event on Thursday, November 21st in Los Angeles with the Young Turks in person. And I would love to see you there if you're able to come, Sonali. And that's at 7:30 p.m. at Skylight Books here in Los Angeles, where I'm based.
My guest, Ramesh Srinivasan, is a professor of Information Studies and Design Media Arts at UCLA. And we've been discussing his new book, Beyond the Valley, how innovators around the world are overcoming inequality and creating the technologies of tomorrow. For our Los Angeles audience, he'll be speaking this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Skylight Books. We'll post information to his website as well as about the book event from our site. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.